Hello, and welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based tutoring in your home by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs in the IEP process.
Welcome to IEP Pro Tips Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Today, we are talking about nonverbal learning disabilities, and our guest, Susan Blumberg, is here to provide information and guidance on nonverbal learning disabilities. Dr. Blumberg is a parent and family well-being coach who helps parents of tweens, teens, and young adults who struggle with developing healthy communication and structure in their lives. She has been a special education advocate for kids of all ages for 35 years, helping families of children with special needs negotiate with school districts for better IEPs and 504 plans. Before becoming a coach, she was a clinical psychologist for 20 years, working with children, teens, families, and couples. Dr. Blumberg specializes in working with students with autism spectrum disorder, nonverbal learning disability, and twice exceptional students, those identified as both gifted and having disability. She is experienced with students with ADHD, learning disabilities, sensory processing disorder, and anxiety disorders. She's also co-authored multiple books on marriage and communication, and one called Parenting Your Child with Sensory Processing Disorder, a guide for parents with a sensory sensitive child. She is the mom to twice exceptional young adults, and one in college and one in pastry school. Welcome. It is such an honor to have you as a guest, Dr. Blumberg. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Wendy, and please feel free to call me Susan.
Oh, thank you. Will do. All right. So let's just dive in there. What is a nonverbal learning disability?
Well, I think it's important to know that the name is a little bit misleading. So people with nonverbal learning disability are actually extremely verbal. What they have difficulty with are a variety of nonverbal skills, and there are three categories. The first is that we see a significant difference between verbal skills and nonverbal or performance skills, meaning visual spatial skills. So for example, on an intelligence test, such as the Wechsler tests, which are the most commonly known intelligence tests, we would see a significant difference that would be 19 points or more between their verbal scores and their fluid reasoning or their visual spatial scores. And in fact, with many kids, my own child, for example, had a 50-point difference. And we see many kids with even bigger differences. But 19 points is the minimum needed to declare this a significant deficit. And so these kids have difficulty with math, which is a visual spatial task, with handwriting, which is a visual spatial task, with directions, which is a visual spatial task. So as you can see, it affects them in a wide variety of visual spatial areas. The second area are fine and gross motor skills, more visual spatial tasks, right? I already mentioned handwriting, but it could be buttoning, zipping, pouring liquid into a cup. These kids miss the cup rim more often than not, right? Gross motor skills, such as catching a ball, throwing a ball, running around the bases, running at all. We used to be able to say of my daughter that she would trip over the painted line in a parking lot. And at 25, we were just discussing this morning that she still walks into door frames and is very uncomfortable walking down a flight of stairs because unless she's holding onto the banister, she really feels like she's rushing down those stairs, that she doesn't have control of her body. And these people can have, and I say people because it can be children or adults, may have motor planning issues. So my daughter had difficulty learning to ride a bicycle because she has to look at her feet to know which foot is pushing on the pedals next. And if you're looking at your feet while you're riding a bicycle, what happens? You can't be looking where you're going and you tend to crash into things. So that's the second area, fine and gross motor skills. And the third area of nonverbal difficulties are nonverbal social skills. So this has to do with being able to read facial expressions, tone of voice, body language, but also understanding nonverbal social content, such as jokes and sarcasm. Many people with nonverbal learning difficulty have trouble understanding puns or double entendres or even basic sarcastic comments because they take everything literally. So if you have difficulties in all three of these areas, your most likely diagnosis is nonverbal learning disability.
It's a really helpful way for us to kind of start this conversation, and you really provided some great examples. What is the distinction, though, between delays, a deficit, and a possible disorder? Because, you know, parents are thinking at all different ages, you know, what is age appropriate? What's not age appropriate? What are my expectations? You know, are there different signs or symptoms that are more common or worrisome? So I really kind of gave you a couple of questions.
No, and it's an excellent question. The difference between delays and a disorder is how much it's interfering with your life. Okay. How many of us twirl our hair? Mine's too short, but yours is long enough. Are you a hair twirler, Wendy?
I am not a hair twirler.
Okay. So my daughter is a hair twirler. Many people with long hair are hair twirlers. Okay. I tend to bounce my leg.
Yes.
But these behaviors don't overwhelm our lives. It doesn't interfere with our ability to develop a relationship with another person because we're okay at reading facial expressions or body language. And so if we don't get a joke, it's not a big deal. But when it progresses to the point where our sensory issues, we're not able to sit still in our chairs, our bouncing is at the point where we fall off our chairs, right? We hair twirl to the point we're pulling it out of our head, right? Our need to have something in our mouth at all times, for my daughter, meant she had four fingers in her mouth. Or she was, many of the kids I see chew on the necks of their shirts till they're soggy and dripping. Now we're at the disability level. We're at the disorder level, right? Because it's not just a little habit or a tip, but it's at the level that we need to have intervention.
So you say, you know, you mentioned sensory, you mentioned social skills, you mentioned visual, spatial, and kind of as I'm thinking, how, you know, what is the difference between ADHD, autism, nonverbal? I feel like some items that you're mentioning could really fit in any of those categories. And, you know, how often, you know, can they coexist as comorbidities, and how are these conditions kind of wrapped up and sorted out, which is probably really hard for a clinician?
Ding, 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 ding,
yeah.
The $64,000 question.
Right.
So, nonverbal learning disability has been overlooked by many for two reasons. One is it's not been as carefully researched by the academic community, and I have no clue why. I really don't know why. The second is that there is a lot of overlap in symptoms among the three disabilities you have mentioned: ADHD, autism spectrum disorder, and nonverbal learning disability. The key distinction is that difference between your verbal skills and your visual spatial skills. No other diagnosis has that as a symptom. So if you have sensory issues and fidgeting issues, you might have ADHD, you might have autism spectrum disorder, sensory issues or symptoms of both, right? But no other disability has that split between verbal and nonverbal skills, only nonverbal learning disability. And if you have that symptom and then you look for the triad, between that split plus fine and gross motor disability, you don't have to have that in either of the other two, plus the difficulty in social skills, which you do have in autism spectrum disorder. But if you have the triad, you have nonverbal learning disability.
And I would imagine, as a special educator, and I know that we're going to talk about this kind of further in our conversation, that this impacts the classroom. But why isn't nonverbal learning disabilities, why isn't that under IDEA?
Very good question. It's because it's not in the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And as I said before, it's because it hasn't been researched as significantly by the academic and research community. Now, I'm happy to report that there have been some new efforts in the last 6 or 7 years to provide new research on this diagnosis. And there is an effort right now by a university in New York to do the kind of research that's necessary to put it in that diagnostic manual that we call the DSM. If that effort is successful, then perhaps the next time around the DSM is revised, which will be sometime maybe around 2025, because the last time was 2013, then we might see that change. And then the next time Congress reauthorizes IDEA, perhaps we would see it covered. But you see, this is a very lengthy process. So what happens now, the way we can get nonverbal learning disability covered, is we break it down into its constituent parts. We have dyscalculia, a math disability, right? We have dysgraphia, the handwriting disability. We might have other pieces, such as the sensory processing piece. We have social skills issues. We have executive function disorder. As you can see, as I already described, a person with nonverbal learning disability could have 2 or 3 or more components which are already covered under IDEA. And therefore, we can have a person covered under an IEP by labeling the disparate parts of their issues without ever having to call it nonverbal learning disability and have that one disability covered. It's unfortunate, but we are able to get services for these kids.
And it's really looking at the individual kiddo and the impact that they have, you know, as a student, or, you know, just in terms of life.
Exactly. The important thing is to know that once you get an IEP for one issue, whether that's the math disability or the writing disability or the executive function issues, an IEP has to cover all the issues a child has. So as long as we get one thing covered, we get everything covered.
That's right. And I think that's a fantastic thing to point out to folks that are listening. Who diagnoses a nonverbal learning disability?
A neuropsychologist or an educational psychologist who does a full intellectual academic evaluation.
And then after their diagnosis, what would you recommend for families to take, like their next steps in terms of treatment and therapy? I know in the evaluation process, there's recommendations. You know, how do you kind of help, in your experience, guide families to prioritize what should be done next?
Well, I think it depends how it falls out. One of our common statements, and you say this about several disabilities, is that when you see one person with nonverbal learning disability, you've seen one person with nonverbal learning disability. So that there are some people with nonverbal learning disability who are less impacted in one of the three areas than in other three areas. And there are some people who are severely impacted in all three areas. In addition, as I have been very careful to avoid saying, this is not a disorder of intelligence. It's a disorder of gaps. So that your highest score in verbal comprehension, for example, could be at the average range, and your lowest score, which could be in your visual spatial area, or it could be in your processing speed or working memory, could be in the below average range. That person is going to need different types of interventions than, for example, someone whose highest score in the verbal comprehension could be in the highly superior and gifted range, and their lowest score could be still in the above average range, and we could still see a 30-point gap. So this person who has nonverbal learning disabilities could need entirely different types of interventions than the first person I mentioned. So we have to identify strengths and weaknesses in that person and then address those on an individualized basis. So the person who has the, say, genius level verbal comprehension score, who scores 150 or 160, obviously isn't going to need perhaps reading intervention or verbal interventions, but might still need math interventions and might still need extended time and might still need executive function because their working memory and their processing speed is severely affected relative to their verbal comprehension scores. But the person who's only reading at the average or low average range and then has working memory, processing speed, and perhaps even visual spatial scores in the low average or below average range is going to need significantly more special education support than the person that I described at the high level. But they might still have the same 30 or 40 point gap. It's just where you fall on the bell curve. And so for each of these people who both carry the same diagnosis of nonverbal learning disability, we're looking at IEPs that could look vastly different.
To piggyback on that, you know, and it really is, we always say that it's just very individualized. And that's a lot of what we do or what we do at Learning Essentials is really looking at the individual student, looking at their individual needs and creating an individualized coaching plan or tutoring plan based on that information. And so I like how you called it a disorder of gaps. And, you know, how do we educate folks to understand that need of that individual child? I think what I'm trying to articulate is that sometimes in sitting in an IEP meeting, some folks really understand the nuances. I think of the nuances. How do we educate folks? You know, if it's your baby as a parent, how do you educate them to understand the nuances of the learning needs of a child?
Well, there's a very good article by a advanced level occupational therapist who started working in the field of nonverbal learning disability in the late 80s and early 90s. And she published what we call the source book for nonverbal learning disability. Her name was Sue Thompson. She unfortunately passed away about 10 years ago, so we're not able to build further on her work. But her material and a fabulous article she wrote called The Neurobehavioral Characteristics in the Classroom is an article I share with every teacher of every student I work with. And I've worked with over 100 people with nonverbal learning disability in the last 20 years, because this is what I specialize in, to teach them how students with NLD work differently than typical students. Students with NLD don't learn by osmosis. And that's what I call it, because most teachers expect you present a routine, you present some material, you present an equation in math, you present a procedure for learning something. And after two or three presentations, you expect a typical second, fourth, sixth, ninth grader to have absorbed that routine, absorbed that learning process, and know how to do it on their own. Okay. So whenever I go into a sixth grader's IEP and I say their executive function skills are extremely low, their working memory is low, they're going to need more time to absorb things. And they say, oh, all sixth graders have that difficulty. This is middle school. They all take time to learn how to get from class to class. And I say, no, you're not hearing me. The brains of these children are wired differently. They will never learn this routine. You're talking about a sixth grader who may still not be able to tie their shoes. You're talking about a sixth grader who still can't remember where their backpack is that they left it the night before. You're talking about a sixth grader who still cannot ride a bicycle because they have to look at their feet to know which pedal to push. Okay, my daughter's 25. She still can't ride a bike. And she's chosen not to drive a car, one, because she has to look at her feet to know where the brake and the accelerator are. And if you thought that was dangerous on a bicycle, how much more dangerous is it in a car? Plus, she can't learn that she has to look around her 360 degrees to know where to steer that car. Again, is that dangerous in a bicycle? How much more dangerous is it in a car? And so at the sixth grade level, when someone poo-poos me that my child's executive function issues are no more or less than that of any sixth grader, I know they haven't heard or understood me. That this sixth grader won't learn how to navigate around a three-story school that has classes on multiple levels, plus has out-branchings. You know, so it's not just around school where eventually you'll get around all through the level and come back to the beginning. But some classes are off to the side too, right?
That they or even outside out. In portables.
Or a classroom, a school that has multiple buildings and they have to travel outside to get to another building. Our kids are not going to learn that. Their brains are wired differently. And so this article, The Neurobehavioral Characteristics in the Classroom for Nonverbal Learning Disability, explains in the clearest possible detail how the brains of these children are wired differently and the kind of repetitive learning strategies, the kind of executive function support that they need in terms of outside supports, the uses of planners, the use of repetition, the use of visual learning schedules. My daughter is 25. We still have to have a list by the front door that has 10 items on it. And believe me, if her head was not attached, we'd have to put her head on that list or she would leave the house without.
That is a fantastic resource, I must say, and that we will definitely put link that in our show notes so that folks that are listening can be able to access that as well and utilize it and share it. And
there are some really excellent books. I will send you three or four in a bibliography that we can also link. I'm sorry, I didn't think to do that in advance, but there are some excellent books. And one I want to mention right up is Screwed Up, But Somehow Not Stupid. And it's a list of essays by a gentleman with NLD. His name is Peter Flom, F-L-O-M. He's an adult, has been married, has children, is a statistician. Math, right? Remember I said you meet one person with NLD, you've met one person with NLD. He has a blog called I Am Learning Disabled. And this is a series of essays he's written about how he's navigated his life with NLD. Really excellent book, highly recommended.
And that's really incredible to say that and share that, because I think oftentimes it's frustrating for a lot of our students because they have these gaps and, you know, there's these really high, big highs and low lows, and that dichotomy becomes very frustrating and then impacts who you are as a person. It impacts your confidence, your ability to advocate for yourself. And so to have this source where, you know, you can see the successes, I think is important. That's not talked about enough.
Yes. Well, I want to say, so my daughter who really struggled, she also has autism and Tourette's syndrome. So she has needed many accommodations to get through school. And through college, she has a BS in biology. And then she didn't know what direction she wanted to go in. And now at 25, she's in pastry school, and which uses all her science background. And she's doing really well. And we fully expect that she will have a career as a professional baker. And we are so excited that after all the ups and downs, after all the struggles to find the right support for her, she's going to have a professional career. So I think it's really important to know that despite the struggles at younger ages, with the right support, our kids can accomplish anything they want to.
And to have those conversations with our kiddos, whether our personal kiddos or kiddos that we support, to have those conversations and really highlight what are their strengths and educate them on what pathways that they can take to highlight those strengths as an adult, as career options. And I think to have those resources and support is incredible for kids of all abilities. But I think specifically in this instance, to really be able to say, here are your strengths, and then let's see if we can match those with real life, yes, career, viable career options. So kind of along that vein, what support or practices can families utilize to help close those academic and social gaps?
Great question. Social skills therapy in groups is one of the best interventions for our kids, but you have to look carefully at the curriculum that the group is providing. So all too often in schools, we go into a school in an IEP and they say, oh, we have lunch bunch. That is not social skills therapy. That is not an evidence-based, scientifically valid intervention. Okay? It's not. You have to ask, what evidence-based curriculum are you using? Or I'll hear a social worker say, oh, we take a little bit of this and we take something from that. That is not an evidence-based social skills intervention. So you have to ask carefully and do your research. The evidence-based, there are several good evidence-based curricula. The one I'm trained in and that I think works really well for kids with NLD is Michelle Garcia Winner's social thinking curriculum. Jed Baker has a really excellent social skills group. Peers, P-E-E-R-S, out of UCLA, is an excellent social thinking curriculum. There's another one called Connections that's used by many private groups. But you must ask the school if they're providing an evidence-based curriculum, just like they're required by law to provide a scientifically based academic curriculum when you're using a reading, writing, or math intervention program. Right? They just can't say, I'll pick a worksheet from the internet and another worksheet from the internet over here. That's not an evidence-based curriculum for a math intervention or a reading intervention. Same thing holds for social skills. So social skills intervention is hugely helpful for our kids. It must be evidence-based. The second piece that's really important is tutoring in math. Our kids really struggle with the visual spatial parts of things. They need appropriate intervention, evidence-based. The third piece, that was two, is that it really does help for to have occupational therapy. Occupational therapy works on two levels. Our kids have both fine and gross motor difficulties. And my daughter did occupational therapy through maybe third grade, and then we took a break and we saw that it was coming back again. So we did an intensive occupational therapy again from the end of fifth through sixth grade. And it was hugely helpful, not just in helping with her fine and gross motor skills, but also in helping with the executive function skills, because it helped reorganize her brain by doing the intensive occupational therapy. We used listening therapy with it, which is the music therapy that has proven effects in brain reorganization and executive functioning. Huge impact on our kids. The next piece of that is let's use accommodations. A lot of research has come out about handwriting. Is it better to handwrite if you're neurotypical? Absolutely. If you're not neurotypical, if you have dysgraphia, which is the handwriting-based disability, your kids should be using a keyboard if they're able to type or speech-to-text technology. Period. End of statement. Our kids simply slow down so much to be able to handwrite legibly that they simply can't listen, look at the board, and write at the same time. They lose too much information. And so I am putting the clients I work with either on keyboards or speech-to-text technology as soon as possible in the elementary years, because they lose too much information trying to listen, look, and write at the same time.
I have so many questions. My head is very full, Susan. I'm going to take a step back in terms of the evidence-based, scientific, valid curriculum. I'm glad you pointed that out, especially, you know, the academic component, and then for parents to be able to ask that question for the social component. Is there an evidence-based math, since math is an impact with nonverbal learning disabilities? Is there a program that you have found really helpful for students that are struggling?
Oh, I think there are three or four known math curricula. You might know this as better than I do, Wendy, because it, you know, lots of school districts use different ones. So I know at least two or three, and of course, I didn't prepare that for my presentation today. So I'm not sure I can name them all off the top of my head. Let's see, Number World is one. Singapore Math is very good. Lots of people like Saxon Math, I think it is. Is that the one that I don't like? Common Core Math, because it moves in a circular fashion. Everyday Math is terrible for our kids because it's not linear. Do you have ones that you like to work with?
Well, I'm asking, and I do, but I'm asking that because I think parents want to know, you know, what can they ask for, you know, right. In terms of, you know, they can absolutely use that term evidence-based valid curriculum. But then sometimes it's nice just to be able to kind of say, hey, right. Do you have familiarity with these programs?
There are ones that are specific, and there's two issues here. Again, right. For that kid who has visual spatial issues, but their math scores are still in the average to above average range, they need a different program than the kids who need a special education program because they're missing foundational skills.
That's right.
Those kids need two different kinds of curriculum.
That's right. And again, going back to looking at the individual and where that impact is and that present level of performance as well for that impact to know, you know, what to ask for and how to ask.
Right. Number World is a special education curriculum. I wouldn't give that to the kid who's performing 2 years above grade level, but in verbal stuff, they're performing 5 years above grade level. They still need help with math relative to their strengths. But so the kid who's performing 3 years below grade level and is missing foundational skills needs a special education curriculum.
That's right. And even just understanding the reading component as well for students, you know, I know this is a little bit off topic, but just understanding, is it a fluency issue? Is it a comprehension issue? How do they impact each other? And so again, just being able to look at the recommendations that are provided through a neuropsychological assessment and looking at your individual child or student and how they're impacted, and really kind of reaching out to somebody like you that can take that emotionality for a parent and out of that, and again, help prioritize what is the impact, what are the strengths, and what can we ask for? You know, and I'm always kind of looking through that school lens because they have parents, you know, looking for an IEP or a 504, or looking to ensure at the meeting that they have the proper supports in place. So you've suggested some accommodations or supports. Are there suggested accommodations or supports that professionals and educators can implement in the classroom, even if it's informally?
Absolutely. These are kids who need a positive behavior support system. Punishments or click up and down systems are disastrous for kids with NLD. Yes, I agree with your face you're making since our listeners can't hear us, see us. Clicking up and down systems are disastrous, I think, for most kids, but they're especially disastrous for kids with NLD, ADHD, and autism spectrum disorders. And that's because, as I said earlier, our kids don't learn by osmosis. So when we punish our kids for inappropriate behaviors, they can't self-correct. So clicking up and down systems, or any system in which you write the kid up on the board for a negative behavior, they just think they're a failure. They don't know what the behavior is you expect them to replace that negative behavior with. So these kids only respond to positive behavior supports, which means positive reinforcement for correct behaviors. If we don't reward them for their positive behaviors, then we're not teaching them what to do instead of the negative behaviors. So positive behavior supports can be implemented in any general ed classroom with or without an IEP or 504 plan. Checking for understanding, which means, do you understand this? Oh, yes, of course I do. No. That means having a child repeat back the instructions in their own words so that you actually know they heard and understood what you were asking them to do. additional time to complete assignments because we've already mentioned lower processing speed and difficulties with working memory, breaking down assignments into smaller chunks because many of these students have difficulty remembering multi-step directions, and putting everything in writing because these kids can't remember things that you've told them verbally. And so having all directions given in multimodal ways, which means not just written on the board, because remember, they can't listen, write things down and look at the board. So if you've written things on a board that have multiple pieces of information on it, these kids can't look at the board and figure out which piece of information is relevant to the current assignment.
Right.
And so they have to have it on a piece of paper that's on their desk. So you have to hand them the written instructions for the current assignment on their desk so that when they get lost after instruction number two, they have something to refer to in writing. These are all accommodations that can be done in a general ed classroom.
And easily implemented that the general education teacher doesn't feel like it's one more thing.
Well, they may still feel that way because they may still have six kids with an IEP in their classroom that have more significant accommodations. But if they want a kid to be successful, these are the kinds of accommodations they're going to have to provide. And if they're not providing these kinds of accommodations, then an advocate like me is going to come in and actually give them 10 or more accommodations in order for this kid to actually be more successful and be receiving FAPE, a free and appropriate public education. Now, I can help parents find advocates. I do work all over the country, and I did this by Zoom or Skype or conference call even before the pandemic. And now, obviously, everyone is
a trendsetter
doing this because I worked all over the country before. But there is a wonderful organization called COPA, the Council of Parent Attorneys and Advocates, COPAA.org. where anyone in any state can go online and find a local advocate in their state.
Another fantastic resource for parents so that they can have their fingers on options and people to have conversations with and that understand the law and understand. Sometimes parents are not sure what to ask and how to ask. I do like that you said for kiddos to say it back. I've heard instances where, oh, well, you know, I'm checking in and the student is sharing that they understand. So I'm not sure why their grades are so low. And they're just saying, yes, yeah I understand. Yeah. And I hear you, but not understanding in the capacity that measures with what they need to be successful in the classroom.
Excellent.
And, you know, in terms of just, you know, encouraging that approximation of positive behavior, you know, that they're not going to get it right the first time. So just appraise that approximation of behavior. Sometimes I hear parents not always getting that little part in there. And I think that's incredibly important as well.
It's so important that we have these positive behavior systems in our homes as well as in schools so that we're coordinating with our teachers and the teachers are coordinating with parents so that we're praising the same behaviors, whether that's on task. It doesn't mean that we praise success or accuracy. I don't care if a kid gets the math problem right, as much as I care that they put in effort to try and solve it, we can teach them how to do it right. I want them to work hard.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And praising that process and working hard and to have a similar system at home as school. So it mirrors each other to help with the transferring of skills and learning skills. And I think that really highlights the need to communicate and collaborate with your school team.
Yes.
So that you can be on similar pages and not necessarily your school team, your child's team.
Yes.
So that everybody is on the same page as what's really working and then you can grow from there. So when working to improve, kind of shifting from behavior and academics, when working to improve social skills, is there an order of operations for where families should begin? Is, you know, one social skill more important? I know it goes down to the individual or more foundationals. What should parents do?
You just asked another $64,000 question.
You'd be a very rich woman if you had all these answers.
Well, I can try. I think one of the really important things is self-regulation. And so what we're working on is helping our kids learn to identify the feelings they're having and learning how to manage those feelings. Because if we can't identify our feelings, then how do we learn to identify feelings in other people? And so one of the biggest pieces of advice that I say to parents is that when we see our children having big feelings, the most important thing is for you to stay calm. The first step in teaching our kids to manage their feelings or self-regulate is that we have to be the adults and we have to self-regulate. So we contain our children by staying contained ourselves. That's so hard.
It's so hard. And especially in the moment, it is very hard. It's hard as an educator. It's been, it's hard as a parent. I'm a parent of three myself. So
And so then what we can do is we identify for our child, oh, it looks like you're so frustrated. Oh, it looks like you're so mad. Oh, it looks like you're so sad. Oh, it looks like you're so upset. Okay. We're trying to give them words that identify the feeling they have, right? Rather than screaming back, how could you do that? You just ruined the table. What do you mean you spilled your food again? You know, why did you hit your brother? You know, they already feel bad. Us yelling at them and us losing control is not helping teach our child anything. So once we've identified their feeling, we can do one of two things. We can say to them, do you need some quiet time to calm down? We offer them an appropriate action to take. Or we could say, do you need my help to calm down? So sometimes a kid just needs a hug, even when they're raging. Some kids just need a hug. Some kids need to go to a quiet place. Some kids need our help to finish the task they're on. So we offer them help or we offer them a quiet place. Now that's different than putting them in timeout. Timeout is a punishment for breaking a rule. Now, if they hit their brother or sister, or they broke something, then yes, they need to be in timeout. If they start calling people you fucking idiot, then they're not being disrespectful and they can't stay in the space until they're being respectful again. I have a very strict rule in my house that we all speak respectfully to each other and you have to leave the space. I'm not putting them in timeout. I say, we have a rule about speaking respectfully. Please go to your room or some other space until you can speak respectfully again. Now, sometimes they need my help to leave the space because they're feeling so overwhelmed. But what am I doing? Am I punishing them? No, I'm helping them self-regulate. So this is just a suggestion I give to parents.
When it's also providing permission, right? So do you need a space to calm down? Oh, you know, you're helping with that problem solving as well. Like it's okay to remove myself. Oftentimes I've said to kids, my personal children included, when they're telling me something, sometimes I'll say, you know, are you telling me this or would you like help with it?
Exactly.
So I don't automatically, you know, jump in and to solve their problem. I just say, and 9 times out of 10, they just say, I'm just telling you. Where I would have just in my head, I'm like, oh, how do we solve this problem? But sometimes they just need to kind of throw it out to the universe. And so I think having that language to share with folks in your space that need that support is imperative and empowering for families.
I used to do two other things with my children. And one was we used to like fall on the floor in the kitchen if they were hungry or something happened and I was busy. And I would say, no tantrums allowed in the kitchen. Go have your tantrum someplace else. And after a while, they'd get up and go someplace else. We had a rule, no tantrums in the kitchen. My kitchen is not that big. And underfoot while I was cooking or preparing food was just a problem. So instead of getting mad or involved in their tantrum, we just had a rule, no tantrums in the kitchen. And they would eventually leave. I'd just ignore them and step over them. And I would just keep saying over and over very quietly, no tantrums in the kitchen. Please go have your tantrum someplace else. So all of these are teaching them socially appropriate behavior, right? And just like saying, I wouldn't say go to your room. I would say you can't speak respectfully. Go someplace else until you can speak to me respectfully. Or I would say, I don't listen to whining. I'll listen to you when you can talk in a normal tone of voice. And my favorite was when they would come up to tattle on me because they were fighting in the basement, I would say to them, if I get involved, the punishment will be much worse. So do you want to solve it yourself or have me be involved? So these are all ways in which I taught my kids to self-regulate. So to me, if I could stay calm, and I didn't always stay calm, but if I could stay calm, these are the messages I gave my kids about how to self-regulate.
Two real quick things before I ask the next question, but
I like that you're laughing at me, Wendy. You're laughing at me.
No, this is fabulous because it's right along the same thing. So I taught at one point in my history, high school juvenile delinquents. And so the language became colorful, but that was not the language that we were going to use in our classroom. And so I, along your lines, would just say, you know, feel free to say that outside in your community, but inside our classroom, this is the language that we use.
Excellent.
And that really kind of helped set up this parameter of when it's appropriate to use language and when it's not. Also, my own personal children, when they were younger and they would complain, I would say, feel free to put a complaint in the complaint department. So that needs to be in writing. And the complaint department, AKA mom, that complaint department's only open on Tuesday afternoon. So feel free to write the complaint on Tuesday afternoons when the complaint department's open. I'm happy to review it and I'll get back to you.
Perfect. Perfect.
Which usually ended in, you know, yeah. I didn't have to review complaints because nobody was going to sit down and write me a note.
On Tuesday afternoons. Between that's 1 right. and 1:15, right? I would
exactly. I mean, you know, you've seen the sign. You know the hours.
Yeah, I think
so. How does
the message is all about how do we teach our kids to self-regulate?
That's right. How do we teach them self-regulate? What is the language and essence? What are the skills that they can again transfer throughout their day and their life? So, how does misdiagnosis affect young children into teenage years and adulthood?
Such a good question. Because nonverbal learning disability, which is where we started this conversation, though we spread it out to parenting more in general, it's a huge issue because it's not known by every specialist. And because we get so many misdiagnoses, it's often found by parents who say, I read about this online. And then they join one of the several Facebook groups that I help administer that are for nonverbal learning disability. And then they take the information back to their schools. And schools say, well, we can't call it NLD. And as I said earlier, what they can do is focus on the specific issues the kid is having, such as the dysgraphia, the handwriting issues, the dyscalculia, the specific learning disability in math, the executive function issues, the processing speed and working memory issues. And because we can break it down in all these ways, oh, and the social skills issues, of course, we can get help for a kid by helping them get support in all of these areas. And so we, the family, may know it's nonverbal learning disability. The school can provide support in all five of these areas, and we can get all the supports that a student needs. Now, in the nonverbal learning disability Facebook group that I help support, many adults are saying, we didn't get diagnosed until we were in our 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And it was mind-blowing because I knew I had all these issues. And I got some support for some of these problems and maybe not others. But now getting the diagnosis is helping us in our hearts because now it finally makes sense to know why I did or didn't struggle in relationships, why I can't date effectively, why I couldn't hold a good job in my field or had to take these other kinds of jobs. And they really feel a sense of completion and a sense of healing because now as an adult, they understand what their struggles were.
Preach. It's yes. And then that changes who they are.
Yes.
And that confidence and it really answers a lot
yes.
of questions.
And joining our community, community, either as a college student in their 20s or 30s, joining our community has really helped them feel the support they didn't feel as a kid.
Because they have that sounding board and they don't feel alone. And so I will also place that in the show notes so that folks that may be looking for a community that they can yeah. receive support with. Absolutely.
We would welcome.
I love that. And it's just a great place to, then if they have questions, they can post it out and folks will be able to help direct them to resources and answers that can really help change their lives and change the lives of their kiddos.
Thank you.
For sure. I love that. What is the best plan of action in school systems for a child who has been diagnosed with nonverbal learning disabilities?
Their families should make a written request to the school for an IEP eligibility evaluation. And that request must be in writing. And that request needs to spell out not just that they've received an outside evaluation of NLD, but what the specific issues are, the way we've laid them out here, Wendy, in our discussion. They have dysgraphia, dyscalculia, executive function issues, processing speed or working memory issues. They need to lay out the specific questions because, again, NLD is not sufficient to get you eligibility for an IEP, but all those other questions are. And so once you've laid out all those specific questions in writing and asked for an IEP eligibility evaluation, the school must respond in writing. Now, if the school denies you that IEP evaluation, I would suggest you find an advocate immediately to help you negotiate that because there are steps you can take. If they go ahead and approve your evaluation, they must evaluate you in all those areas. And then they have 60 days to complete that eligibility evaluation. As you know, they must then meet and say whether or not they find your child eligible. And if they find your child eligible, they have 30 days to write the IEP. In some states, those deadlines are a little different, but that's the standard federal requirement. And if you have any difficulty in that process or you want help for an advocate, I already told you how to find one, or you can contact me and I'll either help you myself or find you an advocate in your local area. If they find you not eligible and you disagree with that, you can request an independent educational evaluation, which the school pays for. And you have to lay out your reasons for why you disagree with their not finding your child eligible, especially if you have an outside evaluation that already identified your child as having issues.
And lay it out in a way that's really thoughtful and methodical almost, that really takes that emotion out of it.
Right, which is why you must make a written request and attach the evaluation you had done by your outside evaluator.
And it's great for parents to know what their rights are.
Yes.
And to give them that timeline of what to expect and what to write in that initial request. To kind of pivot away from schools and IEPs and talking about empowering, it's really been a thread through this conversation. How can we explain the diagnosis? How can you help parents explain that diagnosis to their specific kiddo?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, is there kid-friendly terminology that might help them explain their diagnosis? Kind of question.
Just like any diagnosis, I don't think this is specific to NLD. It depends on the developmental level of your kid. So you're going to explain it differently to a six-year-old than to a 15-year-old. The most common age to identify NLD is between fourth and sixth grade. And that's when academics start getting harder. And especially the kids who are, we talked about on the bell curve, you can kind of be anywhere on that bell curve. And so the kids who are on the higher end of the bell curve and have more intellectual abilities, they tend to be able to skate by until the academics start getting too hard for them. And so the most common age is fourth through middle school age. But as I already told you, some people aren't diagnosed until adulthood even. So for younger kids, I would use the language you would use for any disability. Some parts of your brain work really, really well. Let's talk about that. And those are going to be the verbal skills. They might even read pretty well, have good fluency. They probably talk really well. They might have really good vocabulary. They might enjoy a lot of science TV shows. Identify all the things your kid does well. Your kid is already going to be struggling with handwriting. They're going to be struggling with planning and organization, even at six. At kindergarten, you're supposed to have your materials ready and be able to pay attention to the lesson. And they're even in kindergarten, they're going to be struggling with that. And they may have trouble with their math already. They may not be able to, you know, solve those. If I have three, blue bears and I have four red flowers and I give two flowers, even in kindergarten, they're starting to use manipulatives like that. And your kid may already be struggling with that, even at six. My kid was identified with NLD by the school psychologist at six. So your kid may already be struggling. You're going to be able to give them real life examples of things they have difficulty with. Your kid already knows. Don't think this will come as a surprise to them. Just use real life examples of the things that are easy and things that are hard. At seven, my kid couldn't ride a bicycle. I bet you started trying to teach your kid to ride a bike at three or four. They may already have had difficulty. Maybe they can't ride a scooter like other kids. They already know that they can't do some things like other kids by six. Okay? So help them see and tell them this. There's a name for this. And we found it out. And aren't we lucky? Because now it means we have some things to do to help you. And we're going to use the parts of your brain that work really well to teach you how to do these other things. And so there are strategies and accommodations and supports we can put into place right away. We have them as files on our NLD support group on Facebook. Those files are all posted. The Sue Thompson article I talked about in the classroom, that's posted on my NLD page. A great article just explaining NLD on the NLD page. There are materials we can present to the families and the schools starting in kindergarten. I have a list of accommodations to fit in IEPs on my NLD page. All this material is available to parents right away.
Empowering. And absolutely, even a way to talk to all kids. You know, your brain works really well in these areas, and to help have that conversation to identify what their strengths are and their needs.
Now, at 15, that kid should be attending the feedback session with that neuropsychologist who did the evaluation. They should be in the room, they should have read that report, same time your parents did, and they should be in that room, able to ask questions, because at 15, by law, they should be attending their own IEP meetings.
Yes, ma'am. I was just going to add that part as well, their IEP meetings, so that they can start to advocate of what's going well and what they need support. And I think it's a valuable aspect of the IEP to have that conversation, because the IEP is about that student. And so to take that time to hear that student and hear their individualized needs is crucial. So kind of as we're winding down, is there assistive technology? We mentioned keyboarding, we mentioned speech to text that would benefit children diagnosed outside of the ones that are mentioned.
They should be using planners, whether that's paper or digital. There are specific executive function planners that break down tasks, break down projects, and they should be introduced as soon as possible. Whether you use paper or digital is irrelevant, whatever is more comfortable for the kid. Those should be introduced early on. We should be using word prediction software for younger kids. We should stop all testing of spelling, because spelling is irrelevant. Word check exists for a reason. Who cares if they spell? Nobody. This is just not something we need to make them suffer through. So what my daughter did, instead of having spelling tests, she looked up antonyms and synonyms, and, you know, she alphabetized her spelling list because she was typing, right? So she just used the technology to be able to explore words, and we didn't worry about spelling. My daughter's been on a keyboard since the end of first grade. She has not, and she's 25 now. She writes a grocery list and she signs her name to checks. That's it. I have to tell you a funny story. So she's a pastry chef, right? And they made her pipe words on top of a cake. And now if you think she can't handwrite, she can't pipe words either. And so she has full accommodation. She gets twice as much time on tests. She gets a 5-minute break every hour for her sensory needs. She gets a lot of accommodations in pastry school. So she told her chef that's teaching this class that she has handwriting issues and she can't pipe. And so they gave her extra points and did not score her as strictly on her piping the words. Because, as she has said, when it comes her time to be able to make cakes, she will buy pre-printed lettering and she will never pipe words on cakes. It's just not a skill she's ever going to learn because she has handwriting problems.
But she's come up with a fantastic way to solve her problem.
Yes, exactly.
So kudos to her for doing that.
So word prediction software, no spelling tests. She does not get marked down on spelling. If something misses the spell check, oh well, she can't get marked down for it. planners, digital or paper, I don't care, but every one of these kids. Teachers checking in those planners to make sure all assignments are written down accurately. Because again, remember, they're up on the board. She can't scan the board properly. So a teacher has to check that she's written it down accurately while she was in school. Just all kinds of supports and accommodations for these things. Now with Zoom, here's one of the issues. When you have Zoom, Google Read-Write, which is what's on Chromebooks, the most common piece of technology schools gave out to students, Read-Write doesn't work accurately when you're on Zoom. So all our kids needed a second monitor to take notes on. So I have in IEPs that every kid got two monitors, one to watch the teacher, one to write notes on.
That's right. Because you're talking about splitting attention. You're talking about being able to, you know, a lot of kids were toggling, you know, this Zoom and flipping back to different documents that they need to open. So having two monitors will help kind of alleviate that.
And I'm having schools provide it. It's not up to the parents to provide it. So lots of assistive technology that we need for our kids.
And I would think that during this time, it's opened a lot of doors for those conversations to say, you know, what can really work with assistive technology? And we've had a lot of opportunity to explore that now. And I think that hopefully this paved a smoother route moving forward for our kiddos.
A lot of my parents that I work with have fought for some of these assistive technologies and been unsuccessful in getting them prior to the pandemic. And now all of a sudden, every Gen Ed kid is getting these assistive technologies. And a lot of the parents with special ed kids have been angry because we've had to fight for them before the pandemic and we're refused them. Now, the hope is that not only will we not lose them, but that schools will see that these technologies were actually excellent teaching tools and many students benefited from these technologies and that we should no longer have to fight for them for students with disabilities.
That should just be best practice for sure.
Exactly.
So what, out of our conversation today, what did I not know enough to ask about?
I think this was a pretty comprehensive conversation. I think maybe the one thing I would add is that parents should trust their intuition. And that especially at a young age, and then again at that middle school age, when their kids are starting to struggle more with academics, as I said, that's a key time when many students with nonverbal learning disability get identified, because when you go into seven different classes and you have to struggle with so much more academic material and the classes become so much harder and our kids can no longer manage it through rote memory because there's so much more material to be processed. That's a big turning point. And then again, when we're looking for transition to college and students need disability services in college and perhaps they haven't had an IEP even through high school, parents need to trust their intuition. We haven't said that yet, that their students need evaluations, that they should look at what we've been saying here today about the three areas that their students may be struggling in: verbal versus visual spatial, fine and gross motor, look for those handwriting issues, those math issues, and look at the nonverbal social skills we've been discussing. And if they believe their student could be struggling with a nonverbal learning disability, get those evaluations done. Even if you have to do it privately because your school turns you down, it's important to understand that these transition periods, transition to middle school, transition to high school, and transition to college, are key times to look for these evaluations, to look for whether your child, whether it's just accommodations and a 504 plan or additional tutoring and support, because we don't want your kids to fail as they're making these all important transitions.
And also to know that when you're transitioning from high school to college, because of your age, the laws change, and knowing what to ask for. And I did a podcast a while ago about that, understanding that transition to college, what to ask for.
Excellent. And there are some really good Facebook groups specifically around that transition. I belong to two myself. And if you have NLD, I can help be an advocate for your student. I will attend those disability counseling appointments at the college level and teach them about nonverbal learning disability needs and how accommodations at the college level will look different.
I often ask my guest, you know, if you could put one message on a billboard for parents, what would it be and why? But I think you kind of answered that, right? Trust your intuition, unless you have another nugget of wisdom. But I think you really have shared so much incredible information and resources, tangible resources that parents can easily access, and even educators that may not be familiar with that the terminology of nonverbal learning disabilities, and providing these resources so that they can then now become knowledgeable and become an advocate in their school for these kiddos that so much need some folks to understand those nuances of their learning.
Thank you very much. That's quite a compliment and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And I look forward to sharing all this information.
Can I share how people can reach me?
Absolutely.
So my website is drsusanblumberg.com. My Facebook page is Dr. Susan Coaching. And I have a free parenting Facebook group that anyone can join called Path to Parenting Harmony. And I have a free parenting workshop tomorrow night, which is full, but the next one is January 25th. And it's called How to Help Your Kids Get Stuff Done. And you can find the links on my pages or just go to Eventbrite. And that's a free workshop for parents.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. Thank you. Oh, my goodness. Great information. I love it. I love it.
Thank you for having me on, Wendy. I'll look forward to talking with you again.
You bet.
Thank you for joining us today for our IEP Essentials Pro Tips podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.